Freeland 2 nights I was there, and this is sort of instant pickup. We keep in touch this way. They sometimes just call right now just to say hello, and I think we have that kind of feeling. I never intimidated any of these people, at least after they got to know me.
You mentioned when you did your dissertation that Breyer was your advisor, and that he more or less let you, he supported you, but you more or less worked on it on your own. How do you relate to your PhD advisees while they are creating?
I probably lay less a heavy hand than most of my colleagues do. I tell them, go try to do this, and then ask them how are they getting along, and make suggestions and things. But I think the penalty of working for me is that they have to be kind of creative on their own. I expect them to ultimately do something differently than I told them. Very few of the students have done just what I told them. Most of the things, I pushed them in the direction thinking there's something there, and they found something other than what I thought would be there. And I think most of their theses reflect them as much, if not more, than they reflect me. They certainly should. I keep telling them this, it's your thesis, it's not mine. You know.
Somewhat related question, how do you think things have changed for a young faculty member starting out now as opposed to 1952 when you got your first full-time job in Michigan? Is it easier to start out now? Is it harder? Is it drastically different?
Well, it's drastically harder. I was not expected to immediately go out and raise enough money to support all my research. I had never really felt pressured to get tenure. Maybe it existed and I just didn't know any better. I just always assumed that I would do the right things and I would be promoted. And indeed, I was promoted in 3 years when I had 6, so the issue never really came up, and I was promoted full professor in 2 more years. So I was always kind of relieved of that pressure. I don't think that ever was a factor in my mind. I just knew I was kind of. Now I think the students are under great pressure, and unfairly so. They just have to come and perform instantly. And we do all we can to help them. That is, we assign the best graduate students to the young faculty members, and we're supportive of them, and they don't do too many other things. But still, the pressure to succeed and produce and publish and gain money is really very hard.
Just to give us some order of magnitude difference, how much capital expense is involved in your first series of research problems at Michigan versus what a typical faculty member would have to come up with today to get started in research?
I don't think that it has anything to do with capital cost in the sense of equipment.
Well, that's what I was thinking.
The problem is that all the students at Michigan were supported by a Dow or a DuPont or an Exxon fellowship. So, in a sense, all you had to do was scrounge a little money for equipment, and the computer was free. So there was almost no burden of money whatsoever. Of course, we got research grants, and of course we supported students, but you did not feel that was a necessary thing. Whereas here, every single student, we have to pick up $25,000 a year just to support the student, plus money for equipment and for the computer and other things. So it may take a $70,000 a year research grant alone to support one student. Mm-hmm. And that's the real burden of running on a treadmill to provide that money. Part of it is because Penn is private and therefore has over $10,000 a year tuition, which in Michigan is in the order of $50. But Michigan probably now is $2,000, so it's moving in that direction. All schools have this to more or lesser extent. The state universities haven't, until recently, been much better off financially than we have. But I think it's catching up with them now, too.
It's interesting to just to reflect on how at Michigan and other universities, as you said, in the 50s, were a lot of industrial fellowships, which were the legacy, really, of 50 years of interaction between academia and industry and science and technology. But after the federal presence, after the World War II, when universities began to depend more and more on federal support, it seems that the old ties between university and industry, which led to these fellowships, sort of died away, so that now we have, although we have a new interest in industrial support of academic research, the kinds of bread and butter support that you were just talking about, where graduate students had industrial fellowships, seem to have gone away. So
that's the obvious thing. But you know, the bigger factor may be that the most that my industry gives, no matter what they say, is only to recruit students. All fellowships and so forth are ultimately put in there in order that they would come and have the choice of the best students. And although Penn is one of the places they now know the best students are, and therefore we get more support than almost anybody else, and certainly more than any other department in engineering at Penn, and maybe anybody other important, it's going down right now because the chemical and petroleum industries, which have always been enlightened about doing this, are in a tight belt position. And so there's no question that our support, which has been going up like this, is suddenly turned and going down. Fortunately, many people have given us 5-year grants. And when they run out, if it's Exxon next year, it's going to be very tough to get any money from. DuPont gives us money, but when they were here today, that's where I was talking to them earlier, they're going to continue their grants. But they're taking the long-range view. But most of the companies take a very short-range view, and as soon as they see a downturn in income, Gulf turns off their fellowship. And I guess the times I'm speaking of that were good were the boom times again for research in petroleum and largely petroleum production.
This turning down of the funds for fellowships, is this a leading indicator? Does this occur before they actually experience difficulties? It's interesting for the stock market.
Well, I have heard this suggestion. No, I once heard at an AICHE meeting some stock analyst saying that he indeed used that. That and the fact that he said you can identify the upturns and the downturns even more carefully by the hirings and the expenditures of the equipment companies. Because long before anything shows up, DuPont goes to United Engineers and asks them to go start designing things, and they have to go hire people. And that's the first key of an upturn in any phase of industry. And this time, it's never gone completely flat. All the companies are still looking casually at hiring PhDs. They're not doing much hiring of, you know, the undergraduate hiring is everything.
Speaking of PhDs, you must by now have had about almost 40 doctoral PhD students. Could you please tell us what careers have they followed? What has been your role in helping them to find employment, set up careers?
I got this for you, so I'll look at it.
Okay.
Well, one always tries to help them find jobs. I think this is less of a factor than it is of a chemist who, the professor in chemistry actually goes out and finds a job. Our students, if they want to go to industry interview, and you have very little role in this other than writing recommendations or talking to people about how good they are. In universities, they also have to exert quite a bit of initiative on your own, but you may have more impact of saying, when they ask, is this the best student you ever had, or how was your rating, you may decide a man's career by what you say. And the market influences this, I think. Often people attribute other things, but I think the market influences what happens to people. So when my students went to teaching, it's because the teaching was financially and there were opportunities available to them. When they're tight, then none of my students have gone into teaching. And I don't think that I changed or that I pushed them differently. I think I've always encouraged them to think about teaching as a career. Those that I thought were suited for this, some of them I did not feel were so. And I don't know, I would have to count, but I bet they're probably about 50-50 even today. And many of them have been. This Peter Albrecht, who was my first student, went to work in industry, but then came back and got an MD at Michigan and is in research in biomedical. He says he's a chemical engineer practicing in the hospital, is his way of putting it. So he taught at the University of Michigan for a long time, although right now he's National Institute of Health. Martin Moyle went to work for DuPont down here in Grays Ferry, but then he went to Lehigh and taught and was killed tragically very young. Bill Martini has only taught as adjunct at Washington, and he worked in the nuclear industry for many years. He came from the nuclear industry, worked in the nuclear industry, but he's now working on stirring engines and is a consultant in the area. Herb Zelnick has often taught in universities, but he works for Scientific Design, Ralph Landau's company, and has, I guess, always worked. Well, he worked for a couple other companies, but in design work, Bert Larkin taught briefly at the University of Colorado, but he's been working in the aerospace industry ever since. Mary Gluckstein has been an adjunct professor at Wayne forever, but he works for Ethel in Detroit. Don Sumstrom went to Cincinnati, then to Allied Chemical, and now has been at Connecticut for a long, long time. Bill Luckow went to the nuclear industry and always has stayed there. Roy Wheeler has been at Ford since he graduated. George Clark has been at Conoco since he graduated. Gene Stubbs worked, I cannot tell you where he is. Richard Albeck works for Standard of Indiana. Irving Miller first went to United Aircraft, then he taught at Brooklyn Poly. He's now dean of the graduate school at University of Illinois Chicago Circle, still doing work actively on biomedical research. Bill Zartman, one of the best students I ever had, has always worked for Exxon. Jim Leacock also works for Scientific Design. John Chen worked for Brookhaven for many years and then went to Lehigh Mechanical Engineering. He's now chairman of chemical engineering, distinguished professor at Lehigh. David Helms went directly to Rice and was chairman there and was dean there, and has been offered the deanship at Princeton. It's just a question that we're talking about him. He doesn't know whether he's going to accept it or not yet. And Tom Bath has always worked as a consultant in Washington. Larry Evans went to MIT, and I remember talking to Larry and said, don't go to MIT because they never keep anybody but their own people. And so Gilliland called me mad, angry, and said, why didn't you tell Larry that? And I said, well, it's true. He said, no, I'm from Penn State. I said, name me somebody else. He said, all right, but we'll give Larry a fair chance. And Larry became executive officer of the department and has been there all of his career. Bob Rick has always worked for Whiting at Standard Oil Indiana, but now is with Dow Chemical. Jim Wilkes came to Michigan, went back and taught at Cambridge, then came back to Michigan and has been chairman and still on staff at Michigan. Carl Vinson went to 3M and then moved to Diamond Shamrock. Dudley Seville left, came from Cal Research to graduate school in Michigan, went back to Shell Development, and then has been for 15 years at Princeton teaching. Mike Samuels went to Delaware and taught, and then moved over to DuPont and is adjunct there, but is primarily with DuPont. Warren Cedar, I spent years trying to convince Warren Cedar all during his career to teach, and he had no interest whatsoever in it. And then Don Katz got him working the Ford Foundation project, and he got rated by the students as being the best teacher in the group, and he was hooked, you see. So then he came to Penn.
He was your last PhD at Michigan?
Well, Dudley Seville and Mike Samuels and Warren Cedar all finished, you see, 65, 65, and 66. I wasn't just sure. They were pretty much the last.
So he actually was at Penn before, or was he at Penn before you came?
We came at the same time. Rather independently. He was very shocked. I had been on leave in Michigan, and therefore I owed them a year. When I told Penn, I said, I have to go back to Michigan a year. If you want me, I'll come a year from now. And the president said he would negotiate for me to come instantly. But we agreed that I would not tell anybody at Michigan if I had to stay that year, because I just didn't want to be lame duck, so to speak. But actually, he succeeded in negotiating that I come. In the meantime, Warren had come, and Warren came down here, and somebody told Warren. He came back with a look of shock on his face, but he went to electrical engineering. He told him he would come, and then he wasn't sure he wanted to, because he felt maybe that would be bad coming where I was. But it has worked. We remain friends, but we don't work together. Joseph Chen then was the first, as I said, he worked for Occidental Research. First he worked for Hooker, and then he got the award of the best paper at the Canadian Institute of Chemical Engineers one year. He worked for Occidental, but then he got involved in the real estate business, and he had dropped out of chemical engineering and was in the real estate business in Orange County. And Hiroyuki Izoi, of course, went back and has always been at Okuyama University. Romeo Mandelpaz went back in 1971 and promptly disappeared. And all my letters come back, address unknown. And other students have tried. We think he must be in a concentration camp someplace. That's going to be the only explanation. But it's been 12 years. And he must be alive, because otherwise we would be able to find out. Ford Foundation said they would trace, and then they told me, forget about it. So that's all. They said you would be better off if you do not. So I had no idea what happened. It's not, he was not radical. In fact, he studied for the priesthood before he came to Penn. And so I don't know what happened. Jay Gupta, I mentioned, was at IIT Kanpur. I met him at Kanpur.
Oh, really?
Yes. I went there for a visit and, through the AID program. And while I was there, I met Jay, and I persuaded him to come to Michigan. He did, and then he went to work for UOP, and then I moved to Penn, and he was going to go back to Michigan and came here. And then has taught at IIT ever since. Eddie Heslin was working for ARCO. He did a master's degree, and then I was consulting for ARCO, and a problem came up, and he asked ARCO if he could do it for a PhD thesis, and it eventually worked out. I'm not ARCO, Roman Haas, I'm sorry. Then he moved to ARCO. He moved to this because of his thesis. They refused to let him publish about half of it, and he felt so embittered over this that they lost him as a consequence. Humbert Chu is with Exxon Research. He did work for Shell in Houston, did work for Exxon. He recently moved to Shell. I had dinner with him, as I say. Aaron Wiener died. He was working for DuPont. Mel Bernstein is still with Exxon. Xu Jong-Lin is with United Engineers. He's not now. He's with Hydrocarbon Research. Diane Choi is over at Mobil. Paul Chow, who isn't on there, is with Mobil. Mm-hmm. Louisa Pfefferly, who finished last year, is teaching at Yale. And Harry Kane is at Shell also. I guess those are most of the students.
Plus,
there are a few others that, for one reason or another, aren't on here. But,
well, it's quite a group, and the interesting thing from your running through the list like that is the movement between academia and industry. A lot of them did.
Well, that has always been considered the right thing to do. In principle, everybody says that academic people should work in industry so they know what's going on. But the fact is that you can hire the best young man in the United States on our faculty when he gets his PhD, but you can't hire him 5 years later. He gets, as we say, gold handcuffs. He gets, his salary goes up much more rapidly. He gets married and he buys a house. And if he's any good, the company will do anything to keep him. And so that's what happens to.
Do you see a way around that?
My argument has always been that let them come to school and then hire them as part-time summer and consultants. Warren Cedar always has felt the efficiency this way, particularly since he teaches design. But I don't think he does anymore. He knows he's ahead of those people. Mm-hmm. But it took a long time to get that assurance. But by being a consultant and working summers, he worked 3 summers for Exxon, he's worked for other people. Mm-hmm. I think he has accumulated that, at least, feeling and interface. He has a lot of interface with industrial people.
In that sense, you were fortunate to have that 5-year period in industry when you did.
Yeah, it was unusual. I have more experience than anybody else in the Penn staff because of that. And it doesn't happen very often. And students ask, but you did this, can't I go out into industry and then come back for my PhD? And the answer is, it's almost impossible to do it financially.
Yeah.
I mean, it's all right when you're on a subsistence basis to continue that way. But after you go out and get a salary of $30,000 a year, you come back and live on $5,000 or something, it's very tough.
You've established a lifestyle.
You've established a lifestyle. You're used to having a car. You may be married and have children.
Yeah.
And it's really tough. It happens. There are 3 or 4 of my students did this. Dudley Seville did. Bill Martini did. They do it. But and Peter Albrecht went back and got an MD 10 years out of school, which was a real, but he was a, even then he stirred the whole medical school up. They didn't want him to finish because he already was doing research all over the place as a graduate student. And, you know, it was a very thing. So I think that's it. Everybody, no one has a solution to that problem. And the idea of a year in industry sounds good. Industry always says, we'll be glad to do this. But no young man, can afford to do this. How can he's got to get tenure in 6 years. Mm-hmm. The university's not going to make an exception for that year, and that means a big gap in his research and publications and all this. And it may be beneficial to him, but it's not going to show up when the provost looks at his credentials, I'm afraid.
It's a tough situation.
So it's not a solid problem.
You, having gone through your PhD advisees and bring us up to date, and you've more or less brought us up to the present. And I just have one question. The university puts out a little publication indicating, the chemical engineering department puts out a little publication indicating current research interests. They listed 5 here. I'm just going to go through them, and you tell me if this, in fact, is what you are working on now, if there's anything you wish to add. They indicate combustion, natural convection, liquid migration, rate processes and correlation, and finally, computerized analysis. Is this what you're doing now?
The natural convection work is sort of in abeyance. My only connection with that is someday I'm going with Hiroyuki Izoi in Japan. I have no student here because the government's cut off all support for the area of solar collectors and house heating. I hope to continue that work, which I've worked on all my career, but right now it's in abeyance. And the water migration work is sort of in that status too. It's something that I've dabbled at a long time and want to complete, but nobody's working on it. So those two are more what I'd like to be doing than what I am doing. All my current students, all of them, are working on combustion.
Mm-hmm.
But that's because I have 3 contracts in that area. That's the realism.
And continuing this current discussion, could you elucidate, tell us what scientific organizations you belong to currently?
Well, they're listed here, but I belong to the American Institute of Chemical Engineers, the American Chemical Society, the Combustion Institute. That may be all. Oh, Sigma Xi. I mean, honorary societies,
yes,
like Sigma Xi, National Academy of Engineering, things like that, but the only professional societies.
Okay, and would you also, for the record, list your major awards?
Well, the Professional Progress Award, the AICHE, the Walker Award, the Warren K. Lewis Award, the Founders Award, the Max Jakob Memorial Award and Heat Transfer of ASME and AICHE. I think I missed an AICHE one. I would have to look. Perhaps not.
I think that's
that might be wrong.
And before, I wanted to ask you 2 other questions. One is, we haven't really asked you about your family at all, and we if you feel like saying anything, we'd like to get that on the record as well.
Yes. Well, I have 4 children. None of them are in engineering, although my son is certainly strong scientific proclivities. He's a consulting engineer in San Francisco and works in computer systems, although he has no formal training in this area at all.
His name
is Stuart Lewis Churchill. And my oldest daughter is 32. She's married, has 2 children, but works full-time for Xerox doing things. She's this non-scientific work. But my third daughter, Kathy, who is in Berkeley, California. She's an artist, and she works at commercial art, but she's really a painter and things. She's always been an artist since the day she was born. I have paintings when she was 3, and she's won every award of anything she ever entered, but it's a very difficult area to support oneself and do this. So she's worked as a chef and all these kinds of things, but I think she is supporting herself in doing that. And I have my youngest daughter is 19, is a freshman at Hope College in Michigan. I was divorced from my first wife in 1968, and I married my second wife, Renata Treidman, in 1974. I met her, she was editor of International Chemical Engineering. I met her through My thesis, the AICHE.
This is the rabbit.
Yes. Yes. She has continued to work for the AICHE. When we got married, we thought about living someplace like Princeton because she had just become editor, and it would have been a shame that she would give up that kind of a job after she had worked at it so long. And in fact, she is now the only person with that journal. She does everything with the journal. But Mr. Van Antwerpen said, well, you could take your work to Philadelphia. So she's always done the job since 1974 in our home.
Well, it must be hectic having two chemical engineers in the family.
Well, we have, of course, a lot of mutual friends and mutual interests this way, although our work is somewhat... I help her and she helps me, but these are... So
I need to ask you something about yourself. You are known as the leopard. Could you please tell us how this occurred? And
well, this was just the nickname given to me by some Japanese friends. And they gave me a medal with the Japanese symbol, which is hyo for leopard. And so other people made fun of this fun thing, but nothing very serious.
Well, that brings us close to the end. The other question I wanted to ask you is whether there was anything that we should have asked you that you'd like to talk about.
Well, I don't know. I wrote down some things, but I don't know that I... Any things that are... that we've overlooked. I think it's... as I said, I've been feeling very lucky all my career. It's like somebody who plays baseball and says he gets paid for doing what he likes to do.
Right? Yeah.
When I was president, vice president, I remember introducing Bishop Pike. I don't know whether you've ever heard of him or not.
Yes,
he's a
Episcopal,
very famous Episcopal bishop. He spoke at our San Francisco meeting, and we were having cocktails before the luncheon, and he was telling me what he was going to talk about, which was the impact of computers and all things and shorter work week on society. And I remember telling him, but I don't think it'll have much effect upon chemical engineers because they work 70 hours a week and they will keep on doing so. And we had a little discussion about this, and remarkably, he completely changed his talk and gave a talk to that effect at the meeting. I was just overwhelmed with his ability to land on his feet, and he recognized he might have had the wrong message for the wrong crowd. And he, in fact, went ahead and said that chemical engineers had almost the lowest divorce rate of any group, which it was true at that time, but it still is. He said he knew why. He said most of the marriages he knew couldn't stand the husband being home 4 more hours a week, and that they obviously were so motivated by their work that they didn't, this didn't impact on the rest of their life. And I think he may have said something. My wife sometimes jokes and sometimes maybe is serious about the fact that I would probably just be happy doing work all the time. It may well be true. I do enjoy athletics and I enjoy gardening and I enjoy things, but I must say when I sit down and do research or write papers or things, this is a work of love too. And I guess that's what all of us would like for a career, is to be allowed to do the things that are, you know, self-satisfying and rewarding to oneself. And I think in academic career this has been much more possible. I did not feel that way when I worked in industry. I enjoyed what I was doing and felt excitement and accomplishment, but I was doing somebody else's thing, not my own.
And your work extends beyond yourself. It has an effect upon others who then...
It does, and as you see, my friends really in the world are my former students and the students here now. And, it's also another advantage of being teaching, which is true of any field, that you continually deal with young people and fresh ideas, and you are forced to be involved with change. I think this is a very healthy and desirable thing.
Well, that brings us to the end of a very informative series of reminiscences on your long and distinguished career, and let you just thank you very much for taking the time to discuss this with us and for getting it all on the record for Chalk's Oral History Program.
part of it's fun too, because I've reflected on things that I haven't thought about a long time. It may be done, but it's interesting.